Well, I know it's 3 weeks running now, and I know I'm perhaps trying some comrades' patience, but in terms of thinking about this online communist forum, I myself could not think of anything more important or relevant in that sense, in terms of this week, in terms of leading, other than climate. Because each week that passes, we pass through new highs every week, So this week, the headlines are of roads burning, and we all know the cause of that. I mean, it could be a lightning strike, it could be an individual lighting a fire, but the intensity and the frequency of such fires is clearly part of a bigger picture. And as I've pointed out, over the last few weeks, yes, we have an El Nino event in the Pacific, and that adds, something like 0.2 degrees centigrade to the present temperature. But the overwhelming contribution in terms of hitting records and going beyond records is human-induced warming produced by greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, and all the rest of it. So, what do we have? We have June as the hottest June since whenever. I don't know when monthly records began, but I think it was in 1940. We have the hottest day on July the 6th. And we also have record temperatures when it comes to the seas. I did see a particular figure that was quite stunning, and obviously that's localized, but nonetheless, in the North Atlantic off the Irish coast, 5 degrees centigrade higher than normal. Now, of course, in terms of weather, weather's a funny thing. So, although at the moment outside my window, it's suddenly bright and sunny and it's nice and warm here. The fact of the matter is, over the last few weeks in Britain, we've been having an awful lot of rain and it's been below average. But globally, we've had record temperatures. And indeed, I heard one particularly sad, gruesome story from the United States. I think I mentioned it last week, Death Valley. That's, I think it's in California, but it's on the sort of Nevada border. One of the hottest places on Earth. And bizarrely, though understandably, I suppose, at one level, because it's been busting records, some adventurous souls, record numbers of adventurous souls have been going, well, there you are, record temperatures. I've got to go there. And so we've had, in spite of warnings to stay away and not to go out, between the hours of 10 and 5 or something along those lines, people have been venturing out into the midday sun. And we had one particular incident of an experienced hiker. I think he was in his 60s, but an experienced hiker going out there and dying of heat exhaustion. The fact of the matter is, and I'm not a medic, but I have looked this stuff up, that once you get to something like 40 degrees, we start to, as human beings, our sweat no longer lets off heat, that we're simply absorbing more and more heat. And that's why it's not just the sun, it's just actually the heat causes people to basically keel over, the brain, blood, calling system simply ceases to work. And so, you know, yes, at the moment, Death Valley, you know, is one of the hottest places on Earth. But clearly, in terms of the direction of travel that we're on, in terms of the globe, more and more places will become equivalent to Death Valley. Here's a little statistic that caught my eye, and this is about the Antarctic. So between 1981 and the year 2010, if we look at the average ice cover of the continent, since then, since 2010, in terms of ice loss, we've seen an area of 10 times larger than the UK disappear. Obviously, that's sea ice. That's not going to be land ice. Nonetheless, on terms of the ice cover of the continent, it will also be losing mass, and this will be flowing into the ocean. And of course, the ocean rises, and also the oceans are getting warmer and warmer. An interview, I didn't listen to it myself, you might have. This is an interview on the BBC Today program with a Sir Bob Watson. He's one of the sort of leading British climatologists and has been in charge of this, that and the other over recent decades. And, you know, I've only read reportage of it, so I can't quite get the tone involved. But basically, his message is stark and straightforward. And that is the agreement that was arrived at in Paris in 2015 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. That almost certainly will be exceeded either this year or next year. And indeed, what Sir Bob is worried about isn't just, and I say just, 1.5 degrees centigrade. It's the line of travel. And basically, he's looking not forward in any positive sense, but in dread at the prospect, and not long off, of us actually reaching 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. And indeed, I was looking at a website by an organization called, let me get it right, Climate Action Tracker. Now, this is a very, I think, deterministic view of what's going to happen. And what I mean by that is that it doesn't take into account the possibility of quantitative change leading to qualitative change. So if we discount the distinct possibility of us reaching these tipping points and quantity changing over into quality, their predictions are that if we look at the present situation, in order to keep things to 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, basically you've got a graph that's been doing that in terms of CO2 and greenhouse emissions, you'd have to more or less go into freefall, you know, literally, you know, down a cliff in order to arrive at 1.5. Why? Because you've got a climate system that has got inbuilt momentum in it. In other words, you know, we can bring into play the metaphor of the oil tanker. And if we look at what I've just described in terms of warming oceans, warming air, this will carry on. Even if you actually shut down now all human CO2 emissions from, you know, power plants and road transport, industrial activity, winter heating, summer air conditioning. You'd almost literally have to switch it off. And even then, you'd only just arrive at the 1.5 target that was set in Paris. So quite frankly, that isn't a realistic prospect anymore. And I don't know now any authority that says that it's doable by the date that was set in 2015. You know, if you'd implemented, you know, a radical reduction, real-time reduction in 2015, I would have thought it was doable. But what we've seen instead is from 2015, actual emissions have continued to increase. And the chances are, when we look at power plants, when we look at urban planning, when we look at industry, when we look at housing, that actually, in spite of you know, wind farms and solar energy and more efficient engines and all the rest of it, that looks like it will continue. So although the rate of increase looks like it will slow down, you know, Climate Action Tracker is actually predicting that we're on target. Sounds like something to be aiming for as opposed to something to be warned about. We're actually more on target for something like a 2.5 to 2.9 degrees centigrade. This is by 2100. So in other words, in roughly speaking, three quarters of a century in the future, we'll be touching at something like 3 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. Now, we all know that, you know, in terms of our everyday experience, that's neither here nor there. So today it could be easily 3 degrees higher here in London than it was yesterday in London. And all I can say is I was slightly cold yesterday, and here I am now. I'm sort of quite enjoying the warmth. So what? But we know what we're dealing with here isn't simply our individual response to where we happen to live. What we're dealing with precisely is things like sea level. What we're dealing with is a reduction in ice cover. What we're dealing with is the potential, and this is what I would add into it, into this discussion, is precisely at some point or a whole series of points that what we go through is not simple, something, you know, simple in terms of a graph going like this or a graph going like that. Precisely the danger is that you shift into a different climate pattern. So, for example, it's quite feasible to imagine the Mediterranean, for example, going from its present climate situation to where it becomes scrub. It becomes something like savanna, or even something that tips over into desert conditions. And that's quite conceivable, not only in the Mediterranean, but that's quite conceivable in the United States, of where, you know, the wheat belt turns to desert. So, you know, what we're talking about isn't something that's just about some sort of point this or point that statistics. We are talking about the future of human civilization. I'm not suggesting for one moment that when 1.5 becomes the new norm, you know, humanity faces its end, or even with 3 degrees, that's livable. The real question is how concertinaed change is, and how disruptive it is of a present day economic and living conditions such statistics result in. Okay. Having dealt with climate, I wanted to shift to the three by-elections in Britain, and there's a sort of a natural join, but we'll come to that when we discuss Uxbridge. I have to say that for what it's worth, ain't worth anything, that I thought the Tories were in line to lose all three by-elections. So in that sense, the Selby and Inchy by-election up there in, I think, ruralish Yorkshire didn't come as any surprise. I knew that it was a safe Tory seat. And what we saw is Keir Mather, now the youngest MP in the House of Commons, change a 20,000 Tory majority into a Labour majority. And I think his vote was 16,456. And of course, what that tells us is that an awful lot of Tories stayed away. An awful lot of natural Tory voters simply didn't vote. We had a similar expected result in, let me get it right, Somerton and Frome. And there, the Liberal Democrats, in the form of Sarah Dyke, romped home. She got 21,187 votes. I think the Labour candidate actually lost their deposit. So hence, we have, you know, Lib Dems talking about Labour voters lending the Lib Dems their votes. So those results were expected, as far as at least this individual was concerned. But then we come to Uxbridge and South Ruislip, obviously a by-election triggered by Boris Johnson resigning, you know, facing the humiliation of the Privileges Committee, potentially triggering some sort of petition, and therefore a by-election, which one presumes he would have lost. And rather than that, he resigns his seat. So the Tories begin in a very bad position. There's the former prime minister, you know, who's been proved, at least according to his peers, not just by the Labour Party or anything like that, but by his own side as well, to be a liar. Not just to the public, because that's what bourgeois politicians do as a norm, but to what they shouldn't do is lie to Parliament. So he was caught lying to Parliament. He's a disgraced MP. And what we have is Steve Tuckwell. I think that's right. My eyes aren't very good. Tuckwell, anyway, on 13,965 votes, just ahead of Danny Beeks for Labour, 13,470. So very, very narrow margin. And of course, what the significance of that vote is, isn't that the Tories, you know, kept it, but the whys and wherefores of it. And that's what's come out subsequently. So if you look at the Tory campaign, in Uxbridge, it concentrated on one issue and one issue alone, and that's the ULEZ ultra low emissions zone extension from central London to the whole of London. That's a massive extension. So you go from sort of commercial and you know, bustling London, and you go out there to the suburbs. Uxbridge is so-called metro land. Why? Because they opened up, I think, the metro line, the metropolitan line, I think in the 1930s. And the 1930s is often thought about as the hungry 30s. And that's certainly true in, you know, in places like South Wales, industrial Scotland, the north of England, but down south, around London. This was Boomsville. And what you get is the opening up of new electronic industries, light engineering industries, and also new commuter estates. And so what you have with the Metropolitan Line is the ability of commuters to live in largish houses with gardens, but commuting into the centre of London on the underground system. Of course, it isn't underground, I think, until you get to Finchley Road, which is pretty much to the south of Metro land. Either way, this is meant to be a sort of leafy suburb. It's natural Tory territory, but it's also, as well as being a commuter town in that sense, or a commuter area, it's also an area that's designed for the car. And, so to go shopping, to take your kids to school, often to conduct, one's business, one requires a car. And the ultra low emission zone, puts severe restrictions on diesel, cars that are of a certain age. And basically, if you don't fulfill the requirements, or you don't have an electric vehicle or a hybrid vehicle, Sadiq Khan, the Greater London Mayor, will charge you, I think it's £12.40 a day to travel. And clearly, that is a tax that affects particularly those on the margins. So it's not the poor, poor, poor. You have to have a car, you have to live in such an area. But nonetheless, in the middle of a cost of living crisis, £12 plus a day, if you're just managing to, keep things together, is clearly a blow. And if we look at the swing to Labour, and clearly there was a swing to Labour, it was massively less than in Yorkshire and massively less than it is in terms of opinion poll, standing. So the Labour Party is meant to be, according to most national polls, 19 or 20% ahead of the Tories. In Uxbridge, I think the swing to Labour was considerably, underperforming. And as I said, the one issue that the Tories concentrated on was the extension of the, restrictions in terms of driving and using cars. Now, this is meant to be at the moment, and Sadiq Khan seems to be indicating at the moment that he's going to press ahead. This comes in late next month, so late August, this measure comes in. So I'm myself very sceptical, about this being a general election question. A general election, I think will happen late rather than early. Everything tells us that. Sadiq Khan, I don't think, will be a major issue in the forthcoming general election. But what's interesting precisely is Keir Starmer's response to Uxbridge, and it is precisely to water down any quote unquote radicalism that the Labour Party has committed itself to. This is part of his triangulation policy. And basically, triangulation means you squeeze up to the Tories as close as possible. So you are different to the Tories, but really the difference between you and the Tories will be the proverbial cigarette paper. So the message from Keir Starmer, presumably not just directed at Sadiq Khan, but Ed Miliband, his, isn't he business and the environment? How you marry them, I'm not quite sure. But either way, He's the guy in charge of the environmental policy. Clearly, the pressure is going to be on Ed Miliband to give way when it comes to so-called green measures. And indeed, what we've got in the form of the Tories, i.e. Michael Gove, is actually attacks on what he calls not making the environment, not making climate into what he calls a crusade. Now, I'm not going to use the word crusade. To me, that's a loaded word and conjures up, how should you put it, feudal colonialism in the Middle East, i.e. particularly in Palestine, with Norman knights charging in and invading Muslim lands and all the rest of it. Nonetheless, you know, when you look at the picture I began with of looking at climate and precisely the dangers that are posed in the immediate term, no longer we're not talking about decades off, but are actually happening now to British tourists in Rhodes, for example, harvests here, harvests there, and all the rest of it. You know, not to use heightened language and to actually talk about watering things down is crazy politics. But that seems to be where mainstream politics, at least in Britain, is going at the present time. And it's par for the course, because what we've recently had with Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, and Sir Keir Starmer, is, you know, policy statements on issues which you would never have thought that they would make, given the fuss that there was around them at the time when the Tories first proposed it and then implemented it, around the notorious two-child policy. In other words, if you're on benefits in Britain and you've got two children, you're okay, relatively speaking. But if you've been irresponsible and had three or four or five or more children, then the state says we're not going to pay for them, that you've got to keep three children on the basis of a budget for two children, or four children on the budget of two children, or five children on the budget of two children. And of course, the Labour Party, you know, raised hell and high water when this was originally introduced. And you can see the sort of narrow, vengeful mentality that informs it. And this is the idea of the undeserving poor, and the undeserving poor having, you know, irresponsible sexual relations, and instead of using birth control and restraint as advised by Thomas Malthus, the Reverend Thomas Malthus, have actually produced children, and you are to be punished, and your children are to be punished as a result of that. The idea that this is a rational approach and will actually put people off is just crazy stuff. But as I said, it appeals to a certain mentality. And when the Labour Party has recently turned around and said that, well, they can't afford to change that, and of course here the left instantly, instinctively, quite rightly, protests about it, my response was, I'm sure this has been focus grouped. I'm sure that they've gone to, you know, average chosen groups and put various policies forward and judge what the response is. And so, yeah, I was not surprised when I heard some left-winger being interviewed on the BBC on this very issue, and the BBC interviewer responding, but 66% of the population approve of this measure. And I'm sure that's what set the agenda for Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves. In other words, what we have is a potential Labour government. Apparently now the odds are massively, if you go down to a betting shop, the odds are massively on a Labour victory in the next general election. But what is being promised is the most conservative of conservative Labour governments imaginable, because they're not only talking about such issues as the two-child policy. I've even heard them saying that when it comes to the so-called bedroom tax, that they will keep that as well. And that's, again, irresponsible people who've got council houses and they're on benefit and they've got a spare bedroom. And when the Tories originally introduced this, we had story after story after story of why people needed that spare bedroom. And Labour looks like it's going to ride roughshod over what previously they said on this issue in order to prove their financial responsibility. And that's also why we've seen Rachel Reeves and Sir Keir Starmer give up on their previous pledge to spend, what was it, $28 billion a year on so-called green issues. That we've seen that pledge become, well, within the space of a five-year government, we will aim towards that target. That's the shift that we've seen. So far, my understanding is that Sadiq Khan isn't going to budge on this question. I just wanted to add on this question that while I understand people in Ruislip and Uxbridge taking the view that they clearly have on this tax, nonetheless, this tax is something that's been introduced in response to Tory legislation about ensuring less pollution in London. Because what we had recently, a few years ago, I think it's the first time we've seen on a death certificate, some young girl died and the coroner officially put on the death certificate, cause of death, car pollution. She lived in central London. I think it was in the Elephant and Castle area in South London. And I know in terms of London, how polluted London is. London is a valley, in a river valley, forms a basin. I can remember as a kid, smogs. And the difference is smogs you could see. So the whole of London when I was a kid was covered in smogs in the morning. Sometimes I'd go home from school and it was fun. As a kid, you know, you couldn't see hardly in front of you and stretch out your arm and it disappearing. But when I'd get home, you know, my parents would have the news on and you'd get news report of, you know, how many people had died that day as a result of the smog. Well, car pollution is a killer, except you can't see it. You know, it's not got that visual part that you had smogs. Smogs were a combination of fog and pollution mainly caused by coal coming out of people's chimneys. And under a Tory government, but forced on by democratic opinion, it wasn't something the Tories wanted to do. You had a series of Clean Air Acts in London and coal was banned. And then you had to burn coke and then coke was banned. And then you had to go over to gas or electricity. So clearly the Labour Party under Keir Starmer isn't about changing people's perceptions. It's about adapting to perceptions that are set by the mass media. I include The Guardian in that, but I'd also include The Sun, The Daily Mail, ITV, Sky, and all the rest of it. Okay, let's start to sort of home lap, going over to the Ukraine war, proxy war between Russia and NATO. And we have Russia not playing ball when it comes to Ukrainian grain exports. So they've not agreed to allow Ukrainian ships to cross the Black Sea with grain that's destined for Africa and the Middle East. And indeed, we've seen missile attacks on port and port facilities. Quite frankly, though, in the middle of a war where we not only see NATO supplying weaponry and training to the Ukrainian side, but also imposing sanctions on Russia, we should not be surprised when Russia doesn't reciprocate when we're talking about sanctions release. And indeed, what Putin has called for is a quid pro quo. In other words, you know, if I allow Ukrainian ships out of the Black Sea, then I want relief when it comes to, you know, supplies to Russia and exports from Russia. And we haven't seen such any sort of reciprocation. And so he's been calling for, you know, relief from the disbarring of Russia from the SWIFT system, which is the international system of payments, which of course relies on the dollar, relies on basically this is architecture, world architecture, that's designed to benefit the global hegemon, i.e. the United States. Anyway, the other not surprising thing about the Ukraine war is the lack of progress of what used to be called the spring offensive, that's now the summer offensive. And other than a village here and a village there on the outskirts of Bakhmut, that so-called strategic town, what a load of nonsense. It's not strategic, it's symbolic. And that's why when Wagner took it, having successfully taken it, they went home, sort of idea. They withdrew. They didn't charge on to Kiev. And it's not inconceivable in terms of this summer offensive, Ukraine retakes Bakhmut. That doesn't mean that Russia's collapsed and it's all the way on down to the south and to the Azov Sea. No, it doesn't mean anything of the sort. All it means is that what you've got in Bakhmut, at least at the moment, why I think you can make progress there if you're the Ukrainians, is you haven't got the defensive formations that were built in the latter part of 2022, all the way through the winter months of 2022-23. And as soon as I looked at and read reports from the BBC, Financial Times, and I think it was the Washington Post, although I could be wrong, using open source satellite images of not only the front line, but all the way up along the international border between Russia and Ukraine, of massive, massive defense works being put in, i.e. Whole, you know, zigzagging trench works defended in front of that by these dragon's teeth, 4 foot high series, line after line of them, of these concrete pyramid-shaped anti-tank, I call them weapons, and in front of that, anti-tank ditches. My response really was, well, any offensive is going to be extraordinarily difficult, because if you bombard these lines, well, they're dug in, and they're not just dug in into dirt. They will be defended, you know, in concrete. So Russian troops will have their bunkers, and maybe you can knock them out if you score a direct hit, but anything other than a direct hit, they are going to survive, and they will take a terrible toll on anything that Ukraine sends. And that's what's been happening. So we've seen pictures, I don't know, not read any statistics, because that's kept under wraps, of infantry troops that have been sent out there to demine. I don't know what the toll is on Bradley fighting vehicles or Leopard tanks. Either way, the ratio that one would expect would be something like, you know, 5-1 in favor of the defenders. So, you know, in terms of normal warfare, you're meant to need, you know, as a rule of thumb, you're meant to need three times the number in terms of forces to attack. But when you're attacking fixed positions, you're dealing with, on your side, if you're the attacker, an enormous death toll. And I think that's what's been happening. And so basically what you've seen is the spring, now summer offensive, begin as a whimper and carry on as a whimper, except a bloody whimper when it comes to the death toll on the Ukrainian side. And we've had the promise from Zelensky that the offensive will, quote, unquote, gain pace. Well, when you've not made any progress, that isn't saying much. And even then, I have to say that this armchair general is very skeptical about any pace being established anyway. It doesn't seem to me to be likely. And unless Russian morale collapsed, i.e. the troops deserted their trenches and ran, Ukrainian generals, let alone rank and file, are in a terrible position. So, yeah, we've had the call from Ukraine, not least at the Aspen conference, which is sort of NATO plus conference discussing the Ukraine war. We've had calls for more aircraft and more long-range missiles. Long-range missiles can make a difference. We've seen that in Crimea with command posts being struck and arms dumps being hit and huge explosions and all the rest of it. But frankly, that's not going to prove decisive. That's going to be a nuisance for Russia. It's not going to shift the situation on the front line. And indeed, although we're in the middle of summer now, the generals on both sides will actually be looking at the situation and now basically looking to the end of summer and the beginning of the rainy season. And that becomes the most difficult part of the year to fight. That if you're talking about in the middle of winter, it's possible, because your lorries don't sink into the mud. But in the spring and in the autumn, I can't remember the name of the Ukrainian word, but in Ukraine there's a special word for this mud, as there is in Russian. Anyway, what we would call it is extreme mud, and you cannot fight in that under those conditions. Why? Simply because you have to supply troops. And we're not talking about supplying troops along paved road. We're talking about supplying troops. That's what you have to do along an extended 600 mile front. You have to supply them along unpaved roads. And if you do that, then these trucks get bogged down. And if one truck gets bogged down, then the whole line, the whole convoy gets bogged down. And your troops go without ammunition, they go without food, they go without reinforcements. Hence, generals do not like fighting in the spring and autumn conditions. And that's what they're looking at the moment. So Zelensky is promising to up the pace, which means throwing more personnel, sending more personnel to their deaths. Okay, just a couple of little things to add on to that, just in terms of cracks. We've seen the sacking of the ambassador in London, the Ukrainian ambassador in London. I think that is a sign of fragility of the Ukrainian regime. You know, often we get the image, and that's what the image that the West wants to project, that, you know, there you are, you've got the president, and there's nothing else that exists in Ukraine. Well, clearly, if you look at this, you know, much promised offensive, the fact that it's going nowhere will mean that there's criticism, and not only criticism from the Ukrainian army, but criticism from Ukrainian politicians, rivals to Zelensky. And okay, this particular sacking seems to have been over Zelensky's sarcasm when he was dealing with Ben Wallace, the UK Defence Secretary. But there's also the arrest of Igor Girkin in Russia, right nationalist critic of Putin. I think these are tiny little instances that in and of themselves, I think, amount to absolutely nothing. But nevertheless, we should pay careful attention to them, because I think it does reveal something perhaps deeper in terms of political dissatisfaction on both sides. And clearly, when it comes to Russia, there's not only an anti-war movement, you know, from liberals and leftists, there's also criticism of the war from a far right position, not only from Wagner and Prezetskin and all the rest of it, but from those that think that Russia shouldn't be doing what they've been doing, digging down and hoping for cracks in the Ukrainian regime and cracks in NATO, but should be aggressively pursuing this war. I actually think that on balance, the Russian generals haven't been stupid. They've recognized that they couldn't get to Kiev. They can't get to Kiev, not under present conditions. But what they can do is dig down and hope for political change on the other side. And who can say there won't be political change on the other side when we look at the United States? Now, at the moment, when I look at it, I say that Biden's going to win, but Biden could keel over, you know, next week. He could fall down those stairs on Air Force One to his death. Who knows? I didn't predict Trump won. I thought, you know, when they first chose Trump, I thought, are they crazy? You know, when he first appeared on the primaries, I went, they can't possibly choose him. How wrong I was. So a Trump presidency, a Trump II presidency, and everything changes. And Putin knows that. The Russian generals know that. Zelensky knows that. NATO General Secretary knows that. So nothing's fixed. Nothing is permanent. Quite the opposite. Things can change and change very rapidly. That's also true, by the way, of course, in the Kremlin on the Russian side as well. Okay, lastly, penultimately, general election today in Spain. What's the result going to be? I don't know. But opinion polls tend to indicate, very risky, tend to indicate a situation where the PP, so-called popular party, this is the inheritor party, remember, from the Franco regime, that will emerge as the biggest party. Narrowly behind will be the Socialist Workers' Party of Pedro Sanchez, the present prime minister, followed by, who knows, but one would expect Vox. And then what we have is the myriad different leftish and regionalist parties that potentially could act as the kingmaker for another SWP, Socialist Workers' Party, dominated government. That's a possibility. On the other hand, there's also the possibility, and that's produced most comment, the possibility of a Vox PP coalition. Who is Vox? In Spain, leftish opinion will describe Vox as fascist. On the other hand, an awful lot of leftist opinion will describe PP as also fascist. But Vox is a right-wing breakaway from PP. It was formed, I think I'm right, 2014. It could have been 2013. There you are. I just looked up my notes. Today, it's led by, excuse my eyes, I just can't see at the moment. You will know who it's led by. I can't read my notes. Let me try to use my good eye. Santiago Abascal. He's the leader of Vox. And basically what you seem to have is a general election around so-called culture wars issues. So bullfighting, of all things, is a big issue for the right, and also a big thing for the left. But so are women's rights, trans rights, lesbian and gay rights, green issues. So inevitably, you get with the PP is, complaints about climate fanaticism, which is surely exactly what you need under present circumstances. You also get talk of the Muslim invasion, which is a funny thing for a student of Spanish history to talk about. Either way, what you've got is the left desperately trying to keep the right out and basically, go for some sort of coalition deal whereby leftist and regional parties unite to keep the right out. What I think you've got, though, is two things to say. And that is, first of all, I don't think that Vox are fascist. If anything, what they are is post-fascist, if one wants to use that, or even you could make the argument, and I that certainly would be Trotsky's argument, is that the regime of Franco should be distinguished in category terms to the regime of Mussolini and Hitler, because the Franco regime begins with a military coup from above, not some sort of plebeian movement. So yeah, you've got fascists within the regime, but Franco is not the equivalent of Mussolini or Hitler. Either way, the point would be that if one looks at Europe, what we've got is Europe showing this drift to the right. And indeed, you could argue it's a wider phenomenon than that. All you need to do is look at Japan, the United States, India, with Modi. But obviously in Europe, remember the days of the Third Way and Europe representing civilization between bureaucratic socialism, as I would call it, in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and American or Anglo-Saxon capitalism, some sort of middle road. All of that's gone now. And what we have is Meloni, head of an ex-fascist party, former fascist, call them whatever you will. Clearly, they were fascist in terms of their origins, Brotherhood of Italy. But we see similar parties either in government or at the core of governments in Finland, Sweden. We've seen them in office in Austria, all sorts of different countries. Indeed, Meloni talks about the hour of the patriots, and what she's hoping for is clearly a right-wing victory in Spain, and therefore some sort of project of changing the EU. Meloni isn't anti-EU, she's anti-liberal EU. And the last thing I was going to add in respect to the previous item is that whether it's the Socialist Workers' Party or whether it's the PP, these are all on side when it comes to US foreign policy in Ukraine. Obviously, that could change if you had a Trump presidency, and I'll leave that one open. So last item, and we're talking about very up-to-date politics, there's a general election today in Spain. On Monday, at least, this is how the reporting is up to this meeting. I was looking at my smartphone just before 5 o'clock, that what we're due in Israel on Monday is a crucial vote on parliament versus the judiciary. Remember, Netanyahu, at the moment, I think, is being fitted for a pacemaker. So it wasn't heat stroke that he was suffering from. It was actually a heart condition. That what we're told is that that vote is going ahead. And this is in spite of the defense minister. Again, I'll have to use my eye. Yoav Gallant urging the government to slow down. This is they've previously slowed down in terms of this proposal, and that's basically to allow Parliament to be sovereign, that Parliament decides and not the Supreme Court of Israel. Something that's pretty unproblematic, as I would understand it, in England, i.e. in the UK, not in the United States. So what we have with Netanyahu is basically that the Knesset should decide what happens, and the Supreme Court cannot use, what's their objection, anything that is unreasonable, anything that can be reasonably understood to violate something or other, can be ruled out by the Supreme Court of Israel. And what we have is, I call it liberal opinion, objecting to this. So we have a whole number of different Air Force and Army reservists saying they're not going to sign in for their monthly stint in the Air Force or in the Army or in air control. What we have is massive demonstrations. I think it's a five-day march from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in time for the Knesset vote on Monday. All sorts of protests have been ongoing for whatever since the right-wing coalition was in command of a very thin majority in Jerusalem. Now, we know that from the point of view of Netanyahu, he's not so much concerned about the constitution of Israel. He's much more concerned about Netanyahu himself and staying out of jail. I think that explains Netanyahu. On the other hand, what we have with his right-wing coalition partners is that the Knesset ought to be voting to deny Arab Israeli citizens of their political rights. That's their agenda. What they want is the speeding up of the pace of the colonization of the West Bank, something at the moment that could be struck down by the Supreme Court. And that's why you have this constitutional crisis. So yes, Netanyahu, you know, his issue is pretty, you know, small. On the other hand, the government's agenda, or the right of the government, its agenda is much more radical. Now, what position should any genuine leftist take? I'm talking about Marxist. I think, you know, myself, that we would be very ill-advised to back basically those that want an American-style constitution in Israel. I don't think that we should be backing the liberal opposition. And the idea, by the way, that the liberal opposition is somehow qualitatively different compared with the right government. Domestically, in certain respects, that's undoubtedly true when it comes to, you know, Orthodox men, for example, being excused military call-up and the observance of the Sabbath and all sorts of issues like that. That's undoubtedly true. Women's rights, undoubtedly true. But when it comes to the treatment of Palestinians, let's recall the fact that Israel was fundamentally, in terms of its origin, a project of labor Zionism. Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, you know, the first prime minister of Israel, labor Zionism. These were the people that presided over the Nakba, driving out of the native population. This was the labor Zionism that oversaw the Six-Day War, 1967. The incorporation, in effect, of the West Bank into Israel. Okay, not legally yet, but nonetheless, that has been a labor Zionist project as much as it has been a revisionist Zionist project. So we need to be very careful here, and we shouldn't foster illusions, in other words, in the liberal opposition to Netanyahu. We actually need a strategy that thinks outside Israel, whether that's Israel stroke Palestine or Israel proper. We actually need a bigger perspective if we're going to have an answer in Israel stroke Palestine. There is no two-state solution. That's delusional. No one seriously believes in it anymore, given 500,000 colonists on the West Bank, given effective Israeli colonization of the West Bank. And anyone who talks about a one-state solution, well, who imposes it? If we're talking about an Israeli greater Israel, that's clearly on the agenda. But what do they call it? A secular, equal between Palestinians and Israelis, Israeli Jews, we should add. Well, who enforces it? It's not going to be the United States. So this is, again, delusional. We need a wider strategy. Just a last point to make. That clearly, in terms of what's going on in Israel, we're not only in a constitutional crisis, but we have the distinct possibility of the Israeli army or the Israeli Supreme Court acting against the government. In other words, what you could get is a situation that if the Knesset voted by majority on Monday, that the Knesset is sovereign and overrules the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court could overrule that vote. Then where are we? Completely unknown territory. Does the army then act? Does some particular minister retire? Does Netanyahu die? I don't know. Hopefully we'll get an article by Moshe Makover and commentary by those who know more about Israel than I do. Either way, clearly what we have is a huge crisis in Israel that matters clearly in terms of global politics because of its relationship, not only with the Palestinians, but not least with increased war tension over Iran and the nuclear question. That's it. Thank you, Gabby.